Sir Winston Churchill said, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." And so he did. But another historian took up the challenge, or took up the obligation, to tell the full story of Winston Churchill, and that is Sir Martin Gilbert. You became his official biographer only after Randolph Churchill, his son, died unexpectedly, and after he had done the first one or two volumes, is that right?
Yes, indeed. I worked for Randolph for 5 years, from 1962 to 67, and then he was taken ill and he died a year later. And I was asked to take over his task. He'd already done 2 volumes of his father's story and 5 volumes of Churchill documents. And, you know, I agreed to take it on. I was told it would take 20 years, and I still haven't quite finished the document volumes.
But you finished the basic biographical volumes.
Right. I finished the 8 volumes, which went up to Churchill's death, in 1988. And then I did a single volume, Churchill Alive, trying to encapsulate the whole story.
And all the documentary material appears separately in closely annotated volumes.
That's right. Those have reached, the last one I published 2 years ago was 1941, and I'm even now pondering 1942.
Now, is the book now in hand, Churchill and America, part of the overall plan, or just a sort of an indulgence of affection on your part?
Well, it was always part of my plan. I always felt that the American link was so important to Churchill and so important to Britain and America today, really, that it ought to be a separate volume. Otherwise, you'd have to spend thousands of hours trying to extract the fragments from the multi-volume.
I disclosed in the introduction to this program that one learns that Churchill, we knew, of course, he had an American mother, Jenny Jerome, of New York, I guess, originally, but that she had a grandmother, was it, who was an Iroquois Indian.
That's right. He was once 64th American Indian, and rather proud.
Oh, I thought it was 132nd.
Not quite, but jolly nearly. But he was very proud of it, and although I suppose he wouldn't have been entitled to run a casino today, he always He always liked the idea of having some really heroic American Indian blood in his veins.
Of course, in a famous speech that he gave to the American Congress, he starts with the claim that if his parentage had been reversed, if his father had been American, he flattered himself that he would be a member of this body.
Well, he said, "I might have got here on my own, right?"
Yeah.
Incidentally, he never said that history would be kind to him because he would write it. He rather more subtly said, "History will be unkind to Neville Chamberlain. Uh-huh. I know because I shall write it."
And what did he... Because Chamberlain was the man who made peace with Hitler, a peace that lasted for about a year, the Munich Pact, and... then shortly after the war began, was it right after the defeat in France that Chamberlain resigned?
Chamberlain resigned on the day that Germany attacked France.
Even earlier.
His first instinct was, because the Parliament was against him in the previous week, but when he heard that Germany had invaded France, Chamberlain said, "Well, now I must stay on, I'm indispensable." And his own party turned against him and said, "No, now you must stand aside." Churchill had fought against him particularly because he had neglected the United States.
Sure.
Roosevelt had wanted to somehow bring the United States back to Europe at a conference of the threatened states, and Chamberlain had turned it down.
There's a famous telegram that Churchill sends to Roosevelt, I guess when he ascends to the premiership, the one in which he refers to himself as former naval person?
That's right. They had Roosevelt had asked Churchill to correspond with him from the moment Churchill entered the government on the outbreak of war in September 1939.
As First Lord of the Admiralty.
And he was First Lord of the Admiralty, so he used the code naval person.
Right.
So the moment he ceased to be a naval person but became Prime Minister, he called himself former naval person.
And Roosevelt had also been was a former naval person. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Department of the Navy during the First World War, I believe.
That was very true, and it was really the first bond between the two men. From the start of the naval war in September 1939, Churchill had sent Roosevelt all sorts of titbits about what was happening in the war at sea. He knew that the president, as a former naval person, would be interested and intrigued by anything to do with the naval war.
Of course, the great thing about Churchill in relation to America, and in relation, for that matter, to Britain itself, was that he was sending tidbits, and more than that, quite early, about the danger that the West was facing from Hitler.
And yes, indeed. I mean, from the very first days of Hitler coming to power, Church was not unique, but one of the leading voices in the House of Commons to warn that this is going to lead to war.
And we are going to hear Churchill in true voice tonight with excerpts from various speeches. And the first one goes back to 1938, October 16th, 1938, in which he's essentially giving an early warning to America about the dangers that the West is facing. Here it is.
I avail myself with relief of the opportunity of speaking to the people of the United States. I do not know how long such liberties will be allowed. The stations of uncensored expression are closing down. The lights are going out. But there is still time for those to whom freedom and parliamentary government mean something to consult together. Let me then speak in truth and earnestly while that time remains. The American people have, it seems to me, formed a true judgment upon the disaster which has befallen Europe. They realize, perhaps more clearly than the French and British public as yet well, the far-reaching consequences of the abandonment and ruin of the Czechoslovak Republic. I hold to the opinion I expressed some months ago that if in April, May, or June, Great Britain, France, and Russia had jointly declared that they would act together upon Nazi Germany, if Herr Hitler committed an act of unprovoked aggression against this small state, and if they had told Poland, Yugoslavia, and Romania what they meant to do in good time, and had invited them to join the combination of peace-defending powers, in that case, I hold that the German dictator would have been confronted with such a formidable array that he would have been deterred from his purpose. This also would have been an opportunity for all the peace-loving and moderate forces in Germany, together with the chiefs of the German army, to make a great effort to re-establish something like sane and civilized conditions in their own country. If the risks of war, which were run by France and Britain at the last moment, had been boldly faced in good time, and if plain declarations had been made and meant, how different would our prospects be today? But all these backward speculations belong to history. It is no use using hard words among friends about the past and reproaching one another for what cannot be recalled. It is the future, not the past, that demands our earnest and anxious thought. We must recognize that the parliamentary democracies and liberal, peaceful forces have everywhere sustained a defeat, which leaves them weaker, morally and physically, to cope with dangers which have vastly grown. But the cause of freedom had in it irrecuperative power and virtue which can draw from misfortune new hope and new strength. If ever there was a time when men and women who cherished the ideals of the founders of the British and American constitutions should take earnest counsel with one another, that time is now.
What is his situation on October 16th, 1938? He's out of government, isn't he?
He'd been out of government for nearly 10 years,
yeah.
But he'd been a member of parliament. And that had always been his theme. As he used to say, I sang my usual song, and he certainly did in that remarkable broadcast from Britain to the United States.
What story lies behind the making of that broadcast?
The story was that he was approached by a commercial firm who said, we can earn you very good money broadcasting to the United States. And he signed a contract. And they hoped that he would broadcast on, let's say, witty subjects, amusing subjects, his recollections of his journeys around the United States, his thoughts on the American way of life. But in this first broadcast, he went straight to the jugular. It was immediately after the Munich conference. Britain and France had essentially sold out Czechoslovakia. And as he said, without making an effort to bring together all the threatened nations of Europe to challenge Hitler. And he had just received at his country home in Kent a leading member of the German General Staff who had said to him, we are desperate to find some means of standing up to Hitler and preventing Hitler from making war. But we need the democracies to show a firm, united front.
Which member of the German General Staff would that have been?
He was called Major Ewald von Kleist, and at Churchill's request, he went back to Germany with a letter which Churchill wrote for him. Von Kleist wanted the letter to show the other generals, in which Churchill said, of course, in the first or second year of the war, you will do tremendous damage, even in the third year. But you have to think of the fourth or fifth year of the war, when Britain, and in God's good time, the United States, will defeat you. And this letter was discovered in Ewald von Kleist's drawer at the time of the German plot, the German general's plot against Hitler in July 1944, and he was executed.
Churchill was an amazingly prescient presence, wasn't he?
He'd lived through it all before. He'd lived through the First World War. He'd seen how easy it was to make war, how easy it was for dictatorial powers to make war, how difficult it was for democratic states to get their act together, but how, in the end, the power of the democracies and of the ideals would prevail.
I think when Chamberlain comes back from Munich and appears in the House of Commons, Churchill at that point gets a wonderful comment across. I don't have it in front of me, but it's something like, you had a choice between heroism and war, between heroism and surrender. You chose surrender and you've forfeited your heroism.
Right. You chose surrender and you will get war.
And you'll get war.
Right. In other words, all you've done is postpone the day.
But there were those who argue in defense of Chamberlain at that time that there was no other decision because England was so weak militarily and the Germans had built up very considerable power.
That's a mistaken view, and I deal with that in my Churchill work. In fact, Neville Chamberlain, and before him Baldwin, had neglected Britain's defences. But Chamberlain's dream was an Anglo-German union, and he explained that to Hitler actually after they had signed the Munich Agreement in the early hours of the morning. He said, what I want is an Anglo-German economic condominium. We can establish the sort of economic control of Europe and of the raw materials of Africa. So it wasn't a negative, we're too weak to fight you. It was a positive, we are the, if you like, the Anglo-Saxon nations.
So that does reflect, in fact, a pattern of sentiment which was widely shared within the British elite, a pro-German, even pro-Nazi.
It was indeed, and of course Neville Chamberlain's father, Joseph Chamberlain, had been the great supporter before World War I of there being an Anglo-German alliance, and instead Britain had regarded Kaiser William and German imperial ambitions as the enemy and not the friend.
One hears about the, is it pronounced Cliveden or Cliveden?
Cliveden.
The Cliveden set. Who were, I know that Nancy Astor, a former American, was central in that group, and she was then a member of Parliament as well. Who else was involved?
Quite a lot of politicians. Neville Chamberlain wasn't himself a member of it because he despised intellectuals.
Well, what did the Cliveden set represent?
It represented a feeling that Britain and Germany had so much in common.
The same position.
That Nazism, well, it had its bad sides, but they would moderate. And what really mattered was to be against France and to be against the Bolsheviks, against Russia, and to keep America at bay.
Did those folks also rather welcome the severity against the Jews as visible in Nazi Germany up to that time?
Some did. In fact, I had a very distressing discussion with Nancy Astor when I was a young graduate in 1962 at a dinner table with some very distinguished British politicians. I was a young man and really a fly on the wall, but I was a guest. And she said to me, you know, Mr. Gilbert, what a pity Hitler didn't finish the job with regard to the Jews. And to the credit of the other people present, all of whom were former members of the Clifton set, they turned on her with horror. You know, this was such a grotesque thing to say. And yet she said it. And said it to me, who happened to have been Jewish.
Wasn't she the one who suggested to Churchill that they would have done well if they'd married?
Yes, she was the one who said to Churchill, if we were married, I would put poison in your coffee. And she said, he said, if we were married, I'd drink it.
Yes.
They had a number of very, I deal with this in my new book, Churchill in America, a number of confrontations over serious policy matters. She was always pestering him in the House of Commons. She was a member of the British House of Commons. In fact, the first woman to take her seat in the British House of Commons. And she really did believe in appeasement and that Britain and Germany could get on well together and to hell with the rest of the world.
We must pause for a quick round of commercials and then examine the relations between the U.S. And Great Britain, and more particularly the relations then between the two leaders, between Churchill and Roosevelt, once Churchill had come to the premiership in the U.K. We return directly to Sir Martin Gilbert. We are drawing from his new book, Churchill and America, which is, by the way, just published by Free Press. We return to Sir Martin Gilbert. We are drawing from his most recent volume, Churchill and America, and that after how many other volumes dealing with aspects of the history of Winston Churchill?
About 20.
We should make clear to our listeners that you've got three or four main areas of research and of writing. Yet another is the history of the Jewish people, and more particularly of the Holocaust.
Yes.
On which you've done very significant work, as well as books focused on the current and continuing, and one hopes not eternal, conflict in the Middle East.
Exactly. It'd be nice not to have to write any more of those.
Yes. But coming back then to Churchill, and Churchill in relation to America, I want to play just another brief excerpt of a famous speech. This has to do with his leading England at a time when there was nobody else on his side, when France had been defeated and they were facing very hard times. And this is his famous speech, the date being June. I had to quickly translate 6 to June in my head. June 18th, 1940, when he talks about the Air Force, the Royal Air Force, who have saved Britain, he says.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Already he's, and eternally, I guess, he's signaling the United States. He's saying, if we lose this, ultimately America pays the cost as well.
The day that he made that speech, he had very bad news from the United States, that Roosevelt was pulling back from a promise of sending urgent destroyers, surplus to America's needs, to Britain, which was in devastating straits in the Atlantic.
That was the so-called Lend-Lease deal, was it?
It was yet to come. It was 6 months away.
Ah.
And he had 6 months of anguish during which he couldn't quite get the United States to make the commitment, partly because Roosevelt and his advisors didn't believe that what he was saying, didn't believe that the thing could be so serious. They thought he was exaggerating.
Exaggerating the danger that Britain was in, you mean?
Absolutely, and it was only when 6 months later Roosevelt sent Harry Hopkins, his emissary, to see Churchill, that Hopkins was able to report back and say, look, this man never exaggerated. Every penny, every gun, every tank, every plane he pleaded for when you didn't send it was desperately needed. These people were in danger, and they are still in danger. And then Roosevelt agreed to Lend-Lease and to provide us with American arms, for which we'd pay only after the war.
But what was Roosevelt's thought, and what were his attitudes at the time?
Roosevelt was under great misinformation from the American ambassador in London.
None other than Joseph Kennedy.
None other than JFK and RFK's father, who was telling Roosevelt, on the one hand, Churchill is exaggerating the danger, but on the other hand, Hitler will defeat Britain, and therefore there is no point whatsoever in your wasting the dispatch of American arms. Luckily, Churchill and the British government were intercepting the secret cables from Kennedy to Roosevelt. Of course, friends and allies shouldn't do this, but we do. Probably even today it happens from time to time. And therefore Churchill was able at least to communicate to Roosevelt more and more details, true details. The only person who believed it at that time was the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes. Mm-hmm. And it was Harold Ickes, a man almost forgotten to history, but crucial in my history, who proposed to Roosevelt, look, these people are serious, they are in danger, but they're going to fight on, but we have to find the means to supply them because they simply don't have the cash resources or the gold resources to do it themselves.
There's a curious little revelation in your book about their reading the secret traffic, that is Kennedy's cables to Roosevelt in code, but the Brits were reading it. And only after December 7th, when America's in the war, does Churchill tell Roosevelt, you know, in point of fact, we've been reading your cables all along, but we're not going to do it anymore.
Absolutely. And it was, of course, a godsend that we could read them, because
sure.
Once Churchill knew that Roosevelt was being misinformed, he was able, through his own emissaries to the United States, to try at least to get the truth across to the president.
Much hung upon their personal relationship. Was there a personal relationship already, or did it only form afterwards?
It only really formed after they met in August 1941, still before Pearl Harbor,
yeah.
But while our war had been going on for almost 2 years. On the other hand, from the moment that Roosevelt became president, Churchill had sent him letters, friendly greetings, to which Roosevelt had responded. Churchill had sent him his magnificent four-volume history of his ancestor, John Churchill, Duke of Marlborough, who defeated the French in the 18th century. And Roosevelt appreciated that. Churchill had also sent him, which he always had on his desk in the Oval Office, the currency of the future, which was a pound-dollar intertwined. Our current currency, which has never come yet, may still be, because Britain hasn't joined the euro. Perhaps we will create what Churchill wanted.
Well, he was a great enthusiast for an Anglo-American union of some sort, wasn't he?
Right, from the very start. I mean, from really the early 1900s.
We have him in the 1930s in Chicago being hosted by Colonel McCormick, whose office is at the top of this building. And so Churchill must have visited him in that office in this very building at one point, and then giving a speech sponsored by McCormick in which he's arguing for Anglo-American Union.
He always argued for it. He never quite got it. But as he used to say, if we can't have an alliance, we can't have a formal union, we must at least understand that it's our Anglo-American ideals that are the closest that can be between any two nations.
Yet I learned from your book that Roosevelt was rather wary of Churchill. And though they gave in public a view of two very close friends with absolute agreement on all matters of importance, that Roosevelt was playing it a bit more worriedly than that, and that Churchill was as well.
Right. Churchill never understood quite what Roosevelt meant in his hundreds of cables. Indeed, they exchanged some 1,700 messages. And when Churchill got Roosevelt's messages, he never knew what he meant, or did he mean it? And he often had to ask intermediaries, what does the president really mean here? And similarly for his part, Roosevelt was tremendously suspicious of everything Churchill asked for. Often, as I tried to show in the book, absurdly so. Nevertheless, you know, the countries did have different concepts. Roosevelt's hostility to the British Empire clearly was not shared by Churchill. But they did try, and I think it would be wrong to add up all the differences, which were enormous, and forget that these two men actually did forge a partnership which enabled Hitler to be defeated, yeah, and then Hirohito and the Japanese to be defeated.
It raises and courts the great and eternal question when it comes to the philosophy of history, the question of whether history is essentially just the product of converging and conflicting great social forces which have about them the smack of inevitability, or whether the accidents of leadership and of particular men make all the difference.
I think in this case the men made a tremendous difference, but both men were tremendously supported by the forces behind them. And even at the height of his powers, Churchill understood that without the British public, the British people, being behind the idea of resisting, of carrying on despite the massive bombardments, the horrendous losses at sea and so on, if the British public hadn't wanted to continue the fight, nothing of his personality could have persuaded them to do so.
But Churchill also felt if America would come into the war, then we would win this war, though it would be a long and difficult war. But they're not here. And what do we do to get them here? And that's the issue that we confront in a portion of your book, and that is addressed in another speech excerpt we're going to hear shortly after we pause for these words. The valuable and inevitably very engrossing new book by Sir Martin Gilbert is Churchill and America. That is just published by Free Press. Sir Martin is, among many other things, an honorary fellow of Merton College, Oxford, and a distinguished fellow at Hillsdale College in Michigan, where you spend a few weeks each year, do you?
I do. I come each year to teach there.
And among his many books, among those not dealing with Winston Churchill and with World War II, though I should add parenthetically, you've got two wonderful histories, one of World War I and one of World War II. We discussed those. We discussed the World War II volume some years ago when it first appeared. A narrative history, I think you called it. In addition to those, among his major books are The Holocaust, The Jewish Tragedy, and A History of the 20th Century. That's taking on a great deal, isn't it?
It took me a long time, that.
Yes, indeed.
But at least the century ended, so the history could end.
Yeah. Of Roosevelt, Churchill said to some aide who reports it, no lover ever studied every whim of his mistress as I did those of President Roosevelt.
Very true, and sometimes when they quarreled, Churchill would say to his secretary, well, the wrath of lovers hots up their love. Mm-hmm. So he had this sense that they were courting, and then on one occasion he wrote to King George VI, we are now married after walking out for so many years. Mm-hmm. But it didn't always work well. It wasn't really a happy marriage, though Churchill worked hard at it. He tried hard to find out what made Roosevelt tick, what did Roosevelt really want, and he tried always to defer to him if he could. But it was often difficult to know what Roosevelt wanted, and sometimes Anglo-American interests collided.
Because Roosevelt had behind his back yet another problem, that is a pattern of public opinion in this country. It may not have been quite the majority, but it was strongly represented in Congress, which was well represented by the organization called America First at that time, arguing we go back to Washington, who said no entangling foreign alliances. That war has nothing to do with us.
Churchill was very conscious of that. He made a very careful study of American history.
Matter of fact, the fellow we mentioned earlier, Colonel McCormick, of this very building and of this very corporation, was a strong supporter of that position.
Absolutely, and that's why Churchill spent so much time with McCormick and on the Pacific coast with William Randolph Hearst to try to dissuade them from their views or bring them closer. But Churchill understood that American isolationism was a fact of life, and he was therefore always excited when Roosevelt did things which went behind the back of the isolationists, and particularly General George C. Marshall, the American Chief of Staff, who several times breached the American Neutrality Act secretly to help Britain. But this, at the same time, gave Churchill a false impression of how far the president was prepared to go.
Well, what did Marshall and Roosevelt arrange secretly that did help Britain?
Well, for example, the United States was not allowed under the Neutrality Acts to send war materials to any belligerent power. And Britain was a belligerent power and the United States was neutral. So Marshall cooked up the device that this didn't apply to surplus material, war material. Well, did the United States have surplus war material in 1940? Not really. But Marshall said, right, we'll designate these tanks, these planes, these guns as surplus, and therefore we can send them without, you know, Congress was not informed, without breaching the acts. And Roosevelt kept extending the area of American patrols in the Atlantic, much helping Britain, because we were suffering massively in the Atlantic. And here again, this was really involving the United States in the possibility of war without Congress being informed that these extra naval responsibilities, including convoying British ships with American warships, were being undertaken.
A crucial speech, again addressed to America, is the one that he makes on February 9th, 1941, the speech commonly known as the Give Us the Tools speech. Here he's saying to America, we need all the materiel support that you can provide, and we will finish the job if you just give us the tools. He was still hoping for more than just tool supply. He was hoping for our involvement, which the Japanese delivered to him with the attack on Pearl Harbor later that same year. But here's that speech.
It seems now to be certain that the government and people of the United States intend to supply us with all that is necessary for victory. In the last war, the United States sent 2 million men across the Atlantic. But this is not a war of vast armies, firing immense masses of shells at one another. We do not need the gallant armies which are forming throughout the American Union. But we do need, most urgently, an immense and continuous supply of war materials and technical apparatus of all kinds. We need them here, and we need to bring them here. We shall need a great mass of shipping in 1942, far more than we can build ourselves, if we are to maintain and augment our war effort in the West and in the East. In order to win the war, Hitler must destroy Great Britain. He may carry havoc into the Balkan states. He may tear great provinces out of Russia. He may march to the Caspian. He may march to the gates of India. All this will avail him nothing. Masters of the sea and air, the British Empire, nay, in a certain sense, the whole English-speaking world, will be on his track, bearing with them the swords of justice. The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 millions? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
I can't resist saying, quite simply, how magnificent. Just aesthetically, he is just about as perfect a speaker and thus an energizing leader as anyone can imagine.
He was inspired by the circumstances. He knew how grave the danger was, and he believed every word that he spoke.
It was John F. Kennedy sometime later who, wasn't it, who said something about what was it? He mobilized the English language and took it to war?
Sent it into battle, absolutely.
Yeah. What do you make of the sources of his great rhetorical skill? Well, you've already said it comes from deep sincerity.
Deep sincerity at the base. He had been a public speaker for many, many years. By the time of that great speech, he had had 45 years addressing audiences, and he discovered as a really young man that he had certain gifts, and I think the greatest gift was sincerity, that he knew how to get to the absolute core of whatever the issue was.
But and he also had some very clear principles concerning how you organize a speech. One of them was use short, simple words.
Yes, always use short words. Write your own speech. Of course, he wasn't like modern leaders who have a vast array of speech writers. He would dictate his speeches, and then when they were typed out for him, he would polish and repolish, write and rewrite, and often he would write them out himself in his own very neat and articulate handwriting. And I think equally important, he had studied so much of the speeches of predecessors. He knew, for example, his father's speeches. His father was a great orator and also a sincere and passionate man. He knew his father's speeches by heart. He knew by heart the speeches of William Pitt, who had defeated Napoleon and whose oratory had also been magnificent. He understood the power of oratory, but he always said, he wrote a letter to his mother when he was a young man, which I publish. He said, you know, oratory is no good if the orator doesn't believe in what he's saying, if it doesn't come from the inner core of his beliefs. And his belief that it was essential to defeat Hitler if democracy and human decency were to survive, that belief was ingrained in him.
What did his education have to do with his style? I understand that at Harrow and then at the military, at Sandhurst, he didn't do very well with classics, but he was quite involved in, I gather, in great British literature and great and historical writing, and that Gibbon was especially important in shaping his very mentality. Do you agree?
Well, I agree entirely that it was that history played an enormous part. He read all the history. As influential on him as Gibbon was a great American writer, Motley, whose history of the rise of the Dutch Republic, again, he knew vast passages of it by heart. He read everything. In fact, I was interested to see in his early correspondence, again, I mentioned it in my book, that he was one of the very first people in 1896 to read Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage and to recommend it to all his American friends. He absorbed fine writing, but fine writing which had behind it a strong purpose, and certainly Gibbon and also Macaulay, all the classical writers, and poets as well. Poets like Milton, he knew their work, and so the cadences of the English language were really instinct with him.
Does that art still persist in modern British political life, would you say? Are there any who can speak as well as, and organize public presentation as well as Churchill did?
I don't think people anymore have even the time for the reading that he and his contemporaries did, because in many ways he wasn't unique among his contemporaries. It's just that by the time he became Prime Minister, he was the only one of his contemporaries left. And he, I'm sure, had stronger ideological convictions about liberty and the rule of law than many of them did. But today people don't have the time. I think if you saw the reading list of our great leaders, you know, whom God preserve, they are leading us in difficult times. They don't have the time to sit down and read the great classical historical works.
We have to pause in just a moment for some commercials. I want to get to this one thing, if only very briefly. John Lukacs did a book a few years ago in which it's titled something like Some Days in May. I forget what the exact title was, in which he argues that there was a revolt against him in the cabinet led by Lord Halifax at some time in June, where the future of England's confrontation with Germany was at issue, and there was a real possibility that if they had overwhelmed Churchill, that England might have, in essence, surrendered or sought some sort of negotiated truce. Is that true?
Grossly exaggerated. The book is near fiction. The truth in it derives entirely from my work. The fiction derives from a speculative imagination. Lord Halifax was interested in an Italian offer for some possible ceasefire. One other member of the cabinet was interested. They were unable to sustain one day's worth of cabinet discussion. It was never a danger.
How interesting. I guess I was taken in by what Lukács read.
Look, people like to exaggerate. Basically, those people who wanted to make peace, those people who were seriously in favor of making peace, and there were many, had all been arrested. There was a Defense of the Realm Act. Regulation 18B of that act enabled the government to arrest people without trial, to imprison them under a simple warrant. Two or three days after Churchill became Prime Minister, hundreds were put away, and from that moment there was nobody in the cabinet or anywhere,
by the way,
who wanted peace.
We've been listening to some speeches. We'll hear a few more. What about the suspicion, sometimes offered as fact, that some of those speeches, in fact, were delivered not by Churchill, but by somebody, an actor who could imitate his voice?
He delivered all his own speeches. He wrote all his own speeches, and he delivered them. When the atmospherics were bad to the United States, the speeches were read by Alva Liddell, a brilliant broadcaster, and they were always prefaced by, "This is Alva Liddell reading Mr. Winston Churchill's speeches," and Liddell didn't guy them up, he just read them as speeches. There was one occasion when an actor claimed that he had read Churchill's speech and pointed to a certain speech, and I was rather pleased to discover in the letters among Churchill's secretariat, one secretary writing to another saying they had a terrible trouble with the Prime Minister's speech yesterday. Hundreds of people wrote in and said, "What's wrong? Is it him? Has he had a heart attack?" And the problem was we couldn't get him to take the cigar out of his mouth while he was speaking. So that one didn't appear quite as Churchillian as the others, but he made them all.
We return to further conversation with Sir Martin Gilbert and to a few other speech excerpts that we will listen to after we pause for this. And we return to conversation with Sir Martin Gilbert. We are drawing from his excellent new book titled Churchill and America. That is just published by Free Press. We come to the fateful date of December 7, 1941. Churchill is at Chartwell, his country home, and Gil Winant, the American ambassador to the court of St. James, is coming up to see him.
Gil Winant had been sent over by Roosevelt in March 1941, and he became Churchill's constant companion. Of all the Americans in the war, he was the one who most understood Britain's needs.
He was a considerable improvement over his predecessor.
Absolutely, and best represented them to the United States. Churchill was devoted to him. And they were together at Chequers, at Churchill's official residence.
Yeah.
And Averell Harriman, another of Roosevelt's important emissaries, was with them. And they turned on the little wireless. Churchill had to hear the news. And they heard something about Japanese attack on American shipping. And then the butler came in. And Churchill said, "Did you hear something?" And he said, "Yes, it seems that the Americans have been attacked at Pearl Harbor." So they immediately got through to Roosevelt. Quite something to do in those days, but they got through to Roosevelt on the telephone, and Roosevelt confirmed that the Japanese had attacked. Now, this was for Churchill, in one way, the most desperate moment, because he realized the United States would have to focus all its efforts on dealing with this Japanese onslaught in the Pacific, and Britain itself had had a massive Japanese onslaught simultaneously on its possessions, Hong Kong and Malaya. And so he feared that the whole American involvement, which had become so intense in the war in Europe, the Atlantic connection, would end. And it wasn't until 4 days later, till December the 11th, when Hitler made his most astonishing mistake of the war and declared war on the United States, that Churchill was able to sleep, realizing that now our two countries were together in both wars.
Let's stop for a moment to look at that as a side note, or do a special footnote on this. How do you account for the German declaration of war against the United States?
I think that Hitler was exhilarated. He thought the Japanese attack on the Americans signaled effectively the end of American power, and that now he could get in on the kill One has to remember that his submarines were already able to cause havoc along the coast of the United States. They were sinking ships off Maryland, off Miami. And I think he just felt, this is it. We've got them on the run. They're bleeding and burning. But it was a gross mistake. And Churchill had warned the Japanese 6 months earlier, if you take on the United States, you will be ground to powder. Because in the end, we will defeat Germany, as he put it, as we did last time, and then all the combined power of Britain and the United States will be turned against you in Japan. And you can't stand up against it. You simply don't have the resources. And he was right. He sent the Japanese the production details of the United States and Britain, with steel, for example, and showed just how backward they were once they lost Germany's alliance.
The attack is on December 7th in Pearl Harbor. By December 26th, Churchill is standing before the Congress of the United States, a combined meeting of the House and the Senate, addressing them. When did he come over? How did he come over?
The moment that Hitler declared war on the United States, Churchill said to Roosevelt, I want to come over. We have to coordinate our war policy. Churchill's hope, desperate hope, was that the United States would agree to put the defeat of Hitler first, before the defeat of Japan. Eisenhower, as a member of the planning staff in Washington, had already established that as the United States policy, and his view had been regarded as right. And indeed, there had been secret talks between Britain and the United States since January 1941, almost for a whole year, based on the premise that if Germany and Japan were both at war with the United States, the United States would focus first on the defeat of Germany. So he came to Washington to ensure that that was so. He was staggered to find such unanimity in the American high command that Hitler should be defeated first.
And here he is then, undoubtedly somewhat exhilarated, talking before the combined meeting of the House and the Senate on that date, namely December 26th. 1941.
Members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, I feel greatly honored that you should have invited me to enter the United States Senate chamber and address the representatives of both branches of Congress. The fact that my American forebears have for so many generations played their part in the life of the United States, and that here I am, an Englishman, welcomed in your midst, makes this experience one of the most moving and thrilling in my life, which is already long and has not been entirely uneventful. I wish indeed that my mother, whose memory I cherish across the veil of years, could have been here to see. By the way, I cannot help but reflecting that if my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own. Now, the United States have been attacked and set upon by three most powerfully armed dictator states, the greatest military power in Europe, the greatest military power in Asia. Japan, Germany, and Italy have all declared and are making war upon you. And a quarrel is open which can only end in their overthrow or yours. But here in Washington, in these memorable days, I have found an Olympian fortitude which, far from being based upon complacency, is only the mask of an inflexible purpose and the proof of a sure, well-grounded confidence in the final outcome. now that we are linked in a righteous comradeship of arms, now that our two considerable nations, each in perfect unity, have joined all their life energies in a common resolve, a new scene opens, upon which a steady light will glow and brighten. Here we are, together, facing a group of mighty foes who seek our ruin. Here we are, together, defending all that to free men is dear. Twice in a single generation, the catastrophe of world war has fallen upon us. Twice in our lifetime has the long arm of fate reached out across the oceans to bring the United States into the forefront of the battle. Prodigious hammer strokes have been needed to bring us together today. If you will allow me to use other language, I will say that he must indeed have a blind soul who cannot see that some great purpose and design is being worked out here below, of which we have the honor to be the faithful servants. It is not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. Still I avow my hope and faith, sure and inviolate, that in the days to come, the British and American peoples will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
You, Martin, have probably heard that dozens of times. How do you react to it? I note, as we're listening to it, you're sort of sympathetically vibrating to it. You're even mouthing a few of the words.
Well, it was a very powerful speech, and you cut it off because time was against you at the moment when he brought the Senate and the congressman to silence and to depression, because he felt he had to remind them of the failure of the United States in 1920 to support Woodrow Wilson's dream, the League of Nations, and its wonderful collective security provisions, which would have prevented an aggressor, because all the nations threatened would have combined. And he gave them a history lesson after that last peroration, in which he said, you have let us down, and now we have a much harder fight than we would have had before. Indeed, we wouldn't have had a fight before. And when Roosevelt said to him, later that visit, what do we call this war? You know, the last war is the Great War. What do we call this war? He said, without hesitation, the unnecessary war. So it was great oratory, but it was also powerful history.
You've done history of World War I and World War II. Do you take, then, your reading of the alternative history that would have developed if America had gone into the League of Nations and fully supported Wilson's vision, your reading is that it would have produced, would have taken us to the sunlit uplands of peace in 1919 and 1920?
Well, it's not my reading. I mean, in fact, it happens to be my reading, but it was Winston Churchill's reading.
Yes, I know, but I'm asking whether you agree with that reading.
He felt that so strongly that that was something he brought up in all his speeches and couldn't even resist on this really magisterial occasion. Certainly, I think it was disastrous, because what Woodrow Wilson was unable to do, hard though he tried, because the Senate let him down, Truman, with the Truman Doctrine, and Marshall, when Secretary of State, with the Marshall Plan, which incidentally was inspired by Churchill, were able to do after 1945. That is, to bring Europe together and end this absurd 150-year battle between France and Germany and create an economically viable and peaceful Europe.
Of course, Churchill says in some other speeches, in some other writing, that even as late as 1934 or 1936, he mentions those two particular years, if Europe, and perhaps he means as well America, had stood strongly against Hitler, they could have prevented the coming on of war. I suppose what he has in mind particularly is the occupation of the Ruhr.
Right, the occupation of the Rhineland.
The Rhineland, rather.
No, absolutely, and also the whole developments after that, because he knew from his sources in Germany, and we now know these are true by our researches, that the German general staff, the German army, were looking for some reason to say to Hitler, look, you can't proceed on this aggressive path because you have a superior military force against you. The combined forces of Britain, France, Russia, Czechoslovakia, and possibly the United States.
So we could have called his bluff as late as the Sudetenland crisis in Czechoslovakia or the Anschluss.
Yes, I think both
Austria as well.
I think definitely. He was bluffing up to that point. And indeed, when he invaded Poland in 1939, in September, he was convinced Britain and France would not declare war on him.
Yeah.
And when they did, he was momentarily dumbfounded. In other words, he made a serious miscalculation, because although we were in a very weak position, we never ended the war until we defeated him.
He brags to his general staff that he has an iron will, an eisener Wille, and also that he functions as if he were a sleepwalker. He doesn't hesitate or get complicated. He just moves with absolute automaticity.
That's right. And he also told them, when they said, when he was about to invade Poland, but surely, you know, Britain will come in against you, he said, I saw these worms at Munich.
Yeah.
I know they're not going to do anything. So that was a miscalculation as bad as his declaration of war on the United States 4 days after Pearl Harbor.
Mm. Again, we're overdue for some commercials. We come to the end of the war and the interesting next phase that Churchill has a great deal to do with bringing forward. That is the Cold War. And we will talk about that and hear at least one more excerpt from a very important speech as we return to Martin Gilbert after these words. And we return to Martin Gilbert, drawing from his new book, Churchill and America. We do want to get to the phones, and we're opening the lines right now. If you want to join us, the number, of course, is 591-7200. For any question you want to raise to Sir Martin Gilbert, 591-7200. If you want to reach us via email from anywhere in the world, if you are an Internet listener, the email address is extension720@tribune.com, extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or by phone 591-7200. We must dash ahead to say Potsdam. VE Day has occurred. The war in Europe is over. And Churchill and President Roosevelt has died. Churchill and Stalin and Harry Truman, the new president, are meeting in Potsdam, suburb of Berlin. And but Churchill has to go home for a few days. There's an election. And was that a surprise to him, the outcome of that election?
Not at all. He had run the war as a coalition government, bringing all political parties, had given very high office to the Labour, what had been the Labour opposition, the people Neville Chamberlain had despised. But when the war came to an end, Labour, which had been out of office for 15 years, they were hungry for power. They said, we want a general election. We want to return to party politics. So Churchill's coalition was dissolved. He became temporary leader of a caretaker conservative government. And he had been the strongest scourge of the conservatives in the pre-war years for their grotesque neglect of Britain's defences. And the electorate naturally followed his lead in that and also wanted, as Churchill himself had told his conservative party, a better life. They've had a hard time. Churchill wanted to bring in a national health service. The Conservative Party said, no, no, that's against our principles. And so they were swept away, though, of course, they came back 6 years later with him as Prime Minister.
But returning to Potsdam after the election is Clement Attlee, the new Prime Minister representing Labour. Someone once said to Churchill, you must note that Attlee is a very modest man. And Churchill's famous answer was,
he has a lot to be modest about.
Yes. We know how the war ends. We're not going to review all of that. But then comes a new gathering storm, indeed, to use a Churchillian phrase.
Yes, the rise of communism. And Churchill was outraged when Clement Attlee, the new Prime Minister, the Labour Prime Minister, and Ernest Bevin, the Foreign Secretary, who had followed Churchill's commitment to Greece and Turkey to protect them against communism, communist insurgency in Greece, communist border pressure against Turkey. They abandoned the pledge, and 33 days later, Harry Truman took it up. This was probably Churchill's happiest moment in the post-war years. He took it up. It was the beginning of what became the Truman Doctrine, that the United States would take on those responsibilities which Britain had so foolishly turned down.
And only a little while later, what is the exact date? March 5th, 1946, the scene shifts to Fulton, Missouri. And what's the name of that college now?
Westminster College.
Westminster, of course. And Churchill starts his speech noting that he's quite familiar with Westminster.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a place where he'd learned all his craft and had all his political battles.
And we have an excerpt from that famous speech down at Fulton, Missouri, the one which ushers in the concept of the Iron Curtain descending over Europe from Stettin in the Baltic to, what is it, Trieste in the Adriatic.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's introduced by the then active President of the United States.
Yes, Truman had asked him to give the speech, and Churchill prepared a very détente-style speech, really welcoming the Soviet Union as a future partner. And he'd gone with his speech to Washington and shown it to Truman, and Truman had said, this isn't at all right, and had shown him some crucial material, including the now famous Kennan telegram, George Kennan's telegram from Moscow, showing the Soviets had all sorts of sinister desires. And so Churchill toughened up his speech and made it. And then, of course, once he'd made it, Truman said he'd never heard it in advance and spun away from it. But still Truman remained, as we know, the firm believer in the defense of the Western world against communism.
But he had some persuading to do on Churchill then.
He did, and Churchill, you know, always sought this détente. He always believed that if he could only meet Stalin again, if he could only start Potsdam up again with Truman, or once Stalin had died with Eisenhower and Stalin's successors, that he could somehow get them all back on a track which would not lead to nuclear war. That was really the great fear that he had, that it was up to him and Truman or Eisenhower and Stalin and Stalin's successors, that they had a responsibility to the world to sit down and not allow things to escalate into war.
Yet, in this speech, what he's saying in a way is we've got another long and dreadful confrontation that we must play through.
He does.
And at high cost.
Right. And he calls the speech the sinews of peace. Yeah. In other words, he proposes in the speech that if we are strong on that basis, we can parley. We arm to parley was his great phrase.
It was indeed. Here is an excerpt from that speech.
I spoke earlier, ladies and gentlemen, of the temple of peace. Workmen from all countries must build that temple. If two of the workmen know each other particularly well and are old friends, if their families are intermingled, if they have faith in each other's purpose, hope in each other's future, and charity towards each other's shortcomings, to quote some good words I read here the other day, why cannot they work together at the common task as friends and partners? Why can they not share their tools and thus increase each other's working powers? Indeed, they must do so, or else the temple may not be built, or being built it may collapse, and we should all be proved again unteachable, and have to go and try to learn again for a third time in a school of war incomparably more rigorous than that from which we have just been released. The Dark Ages may return. The Stone Age may return on the gleaming wings of science. And what might now shower immeasurable material blessings upon mankind may even bring about its total destruction. Beware, I say, time may be short. Do not let us take the course of allowing events to drift along until it is too late. If there is to be a fraternal association of the kind I have described, with all the extra strength and security which both our countries can derive from it, let us make sure that that great fact is known to the world, and that it plays its part in steadying and stabilizing the foundations of peace. There is the path of wisdom. Prevention is better than cure. A shadow has fallen upon the scenes so lately lighted by the Allied victory. Nobody knows what Soviet Russia and its communist international organization intends to do in the immediate future, or what are the limits, if any, to their expansive and proselytizing tendencies. I have a strong admiration and regard for the valiant Russian people. I am for my wartime comrade, Marshal Stalin. There is deep sympathy and goodwill in Britain, and I doubt not here also towards the peoples of all the Russians, and a resolve to persevere through many differences and rebuffs in establishing lasting friendships. We understand the Russian need to be secure on our western frontiers. By the removal of all possibility of German aggression, we welcome Russia to our rightful place among the leading nations of the world. We welcome her flag upon the seas. Above all, we welcome, or should welcome, constant, frequent, and growing contacts between the Russian people and our own peoples on both sides of the Atlantic. It is my duty, however, for I am sure you would not wish me to state the facts as I see them to you. It is my duty to place before you certain facts about the present position in Europe. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow. Police governments are prevailing from Moscow. Yet Athens alone, Greece, with its immortal glories, is free to decide its future at an election under British, American, and French observation. The Russian-dominated Polish government has been encouraged to make enormous and wrongful inroads upon Germany, and mass expulsions of millions of Germans on a scale grievous and undreamed of are now taking place. The communist parties, which were very small in all these eastern states of Europe, have been raised to preeminence and power far beyond their numbers, and are seeking everywhere to obtain totalitarian control. Police governments are prevailing in nearly every case, and so far, except in Czechoslovakia, there is no true democracy.
We haven't taken the speech to its end, to be sure, but still, that is the core of it, is it not?
Yes, it's very essential. The realization of what had happened in Eastern Europe, and was still happening because the Czechoslovakia, no. which he described as democratic, was soon to come under communist control. This concept of the Iron Curtain, which he'd first expounded to Truman while the war was still on in April 1945, and this extraordinary realization that we either have to talk or there will be destruction. He felt that very strongly and was really to devote the rest of his active life, particularly vis-a-vis the United States, trying to get some sort of summit. He coined the word summit 4 years later for the meeting of heads of state, what we now are so familiar with, to try to get Eisenhower to go with him to Moscow to meet Stalin's successors and start talking. As he said, jaw-jaw is better than war-war.
If they had achieved such summitry and had a full go at attempting to conciliate with the Soviets, could they have carried that off? Or was the playing through of the Cold War over the following 40 years a kind of required inevitability in the history of Europe?
I don't think anything's inevitable. As Churchill used to say, the future, though imminent, is obscure.
Yes.
All we know is it didn't happen, that Eisenhower, and in particular John Foster Dulles, his Secretary of State, was totally opposed to even trying it. Churchill's argument was, what harm is there in trying it? I mean, they may rebuff us. He even uses that word rebuff in his speech. But at least we should try it. We owe it to the peoples of the world that we, the leaders, should be seen to try.
Then you would fault American leadership for some rigidity in this matter.
Well, I don't fault anybody. That was the American position. That was Eisenhower and Dulles' position. Whether it would have been Truman's position, we don't know. And, of course, subsequently, the United States took the lead in summitry. And all the great summits of the 70s and 80s, really, without the United States, they wouldn't have come to be.
But the final end of the Cold War was achieved only when the Soviet Union collapsed as a workable state.
Right, and when Churchill came to MIT, another speech which is worth listening to, in 1950, he predicted that. But he said, we don't know when it'll happen. Mm-hmm. He said, but tyranny will be overthrown. That a spark coming, as he said, from God knows where, and then the whole apparatus of tyranny crumbles to the ground. And it's just sad that he didn't live to see that happen as it did in 1991, some 25 years after his death.
I must pause once again, and we do want to go to the phones directly after a quick interlude of commercials. The number 591-7200. If you've been trying to reach us, try again. We've cleared a few lines. 591-7200. The volume by Martin Gilbert that we are drawing from in this conversation tonight, though hardly doing full justice to the richness of this work, is titled Churchill and America, and published by Free Press. Eminently readable, full of wonderful surprises at almost every turn, with all the documentation that you provide, and most of which I haven't referred to yet, and won't have time to refer to. That's the frustration of doing a mere two-hour program on a subject of this breadth and range. But we go now to the phones. 591, the volume that I say is titled Churchill and America, Free Press, the publishers, and here, the first caller. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, Milt. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Great show again, up to your usual high standards. Question for author Gilbert. I recall the war, there being a notion that Churchill really would have preferred the United States to invade not at Normandy, but to invade in Greece and to come up through Greece and to the north, and thereby isolate the Soviets to the east of that line and not allow them into the Eastern European countries or Germany and so on. Was there accuracy to that desire on Churchill's part?
Good question. It wasn't in fact Greece, but the northern Adriatic, much closer to Austria and Germany, and this idea was originally put forward at the Casablanca Conference in January 1943 by Roosevelt himself. But when Churchill raised it, Stalin turned against it, because, of course, Stalin didn't want the Anglo-American army preceding him into Central Europe. Once the Stalin had turned it down, then, of course, Normandy became the sole direction of the Allied forces, and everything was done to make sure that succeeded. It was a touch and go, but every effort was made, and it did succeed.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, in hindsight, probably decades of pain would have been avoided by an Eastern European invasion.
I think that is true, and I think Churchill always felt that and writes about it in his memoirs.
Mm-hmm. We thank you, sir, for the call.
I look forward to your book.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling, and here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I wanted to ask, what was Churchill's attitude toward Gandhi, and did he underestimate Gandhi, and did Churchill ever accommodate himself to the loss of India, the crown jewel of the British Empire and Indian independence?
Yes, he did underestimate Gandhi, and then when the India Act was passed in 1935, giving India self-government. He totally supported it. I mean, he was a great parliamentarian. He said, this is the decision of the British Parliament. And he then entered into correspondence with Gandhi, very moving correspondence, which I published in one of my books. And indeed, I'm shortly going to write a book called Churchill in India. And there he said to Gandhi, I no longer care now that the Indian self-government is part of the British law. I no longer care if you're more or less loyal to Britain. What matters is what you do for the Indian people. And they then had quite a discussion about what this meant. So he buried the hatchet. And when in 1947, after his government brought in independence for India, and many conservatives wanted to oppose it in the House of Commons, it was a good political battle, Churchill said no. Independence should not be the gift of any one party, it should be the gift of the nation, and therefore he persuaded the Conservatives to vote for Indian independence without a political battle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir.
Okay, sure.
A portion of a rather long set of questions sent by one listener. How does one explain Churchill's speech in the city of Rome, praising Mussolini's efforts in providing a bulwark against Soviet Russia? The year was 1929, the month, I believe, September.
Churchill was Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was visiting Rome. He was negotiating a very important debt agreement with Italy because the United States had let Britain down so badly and was really wringing every penny out of us without allowing us to recoup the debts owed by others. And Mussolini was a bulwark against communism. His fascism was not of the Nazi mold. For example, he would not allow a single Jew to be deported from Italy. Hitler had to occupy Italy in order to extract the Jews. Mm-hmm. And communism was then a grave danger. I mean, as we saw what happened in 1945, the whole areas which were independent in 1929 fell under Soviet rule until 1991.
I must ask your indulgence. That brings to mind something I've wondered and worried about a good deal. You're an intellectual. I aspire to be one. I may make it before I cash in. The British intellectuals these days, I think of Marxism. The Soviet Union is gone. There's only one Marxist regime, real Marxist regime, left in the world, I think, and that's North Korea. I think one has to put the People's Republic of China in a special category. Why do so many British intellectuals lean so heavily, as do many American university-based intellectuals as well, toward the sort of Marxoid vision of the present arraignment of power and where ultimate justice lies? And I have in mind particularly, of course, their hostility towards a nation that you and I treasure, namely Israel.
I think that in the 1930s, it appeared to intellectuals in Britain and also intellectuals here in the States that there were two forces in the world, the fascist Nazi forces on the one hand and the communist forces on the other, and that you had somehow to be on one side or the other, that if you were anti-fascist, you were pro-communist. And indeed, in one of the most important speeches he made in his life, in Paris in 1936, Churchill said, actually, we, the liberal democratic states, those who believe in the rule of law, those who have parliamentary systems, those whom the rights of the individual are important, we ought to have our own ideology too. You know, we don't have to go either to, as he put it, the extremes of Comrade Trotsky or Herr Goebbels for our inspiration. But it took a long time, I think, for both Britain and America to understand that we had our own ideology and our own precious beliefs which had to be defended. It's interesting because you mentioned Israel, that he was a strong believer in Israel because he saw that Israel was attempting to build and did build a parliamentary democracy with the rule of law. He was a great supporter of it for those very reasons, that it too had understood that its place was with what I call them the decent nations of the world, of which Britain and America are two.
But I have in mind, for example, the action by that large association of British professors who refused to have anything to do with certain Israeli universities.
Yes, whether they're Marxist or not, I don't know. They're certainly very foolish and wrong-headed. One has to accept, and oddly enough, Churchill saw this when he visited Palestine, as it then was in 1921, and he was confronted with an extraordinary extremism of language and demands by the Palestinian Arabs of those days. He had quite a nasty dose and exposure to Islamic fundamentalism, and it put him off. And it's extraordinary to me that this Islamic fundamentalism is attractive to people in British universities. I mean, it's fair to say that they were a minority and that they didn't get their way. Nevertheless, this sort of anti-Israel pullulates. It pullulates in British society a bit. And it's very unfortunate because I think it completely misunderstands the nature of Israeli society, which has been misrepresented generally in the British press. The American press is much, I think, fairer. But even then, I mean, you find the State Department not always understanding the exact conflict. I mean, Churchill always used to say you can't be neutral between the fire and the firefighters. And in a way, that's true in the Middle East.
A last round of commercials that must be handled, and then we will return for a few more calls. We return to Sir Martin Gilbert, and back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, Dr. Rosenberg. Thank you for this wonderful program.
Sponsor, go ahead.
Sir Martin, I read in your wonderful book, In Search of Churchill, that young Winston met a man in New York, an Irish politician named Burke Cochran.
Yes.
And I was wondering if, in your new volume, if you discuss how he influenced Mr. Churchill.
Yes, I do mention that. And in fact, Milt Rosenberg asked me a question about Churchill's oratory a little while back on this program. And when Churchill heard Burke Cochran speak, he was absolutely entranced. It was a new type of oratory, a sort of Irish-American Tammany Hall oratory, which you'd not heard before. And in 1960, when Churchill's very old man, Adlai Stevenson, called on him, and Churchill said to Stevenson, you know, one of the greatest influences on my oratory was an American. And he proceeded to recite long passages of Burke Cochran's oratory, which he'd learned by heart 60 years ago. Cochran was good. They had a good correspondence. But in the end, Cochran went a step too far. He warned Churchill about accepting office in the new government after Churchill had crossed from one party to another. He said this smacks of too much ambition, too much young man in a hurry. And, well, Churchill was ambitious and he was in a hurry and he didn't like this advice. And in a curious way, their friendship petered out.
Didn't he write to him from South Africa in prison?
He did indeed. He wrote to Burke Cochran on his 25th birthday, when Churchill was 25, and he was a prisoner of the Boers in South Africa. And he wrote a fascinating letter. He just read an amazing American book called Wealth Against Commonwealth by Henry Demarest Lloyd, The First Attack on Monopoly Capitalism. And Churchill was so impressed by this that he wrote to Burke Cochran saying, merchant princes are all very well, but if I have anything to say for it, theirs will not be the world of the future.
That's remarkable. And is it true that you still write all your books by hand?
No, I now type with two fingers on a keyboard. But I still have a lot of pen and ink for my private correspondence.
Well, congratulations on a wonderful work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for the call. An email from a listener in near New York City, in Garden City, New York, who says, Milton, I guess he means me, sometimes asks how history would have been different if Hitler had been killed on the Western Front in World War One. It's a good... I do indeed, because that's a good way of raising the question of historical inevitability and the role of individuals in relation to unwinding social forces. Then, returning to this, how would it have been different if Churchill had been killed in South Africa? Was Churchill's presence essential to the defeat of Hitler?
Well, first of all, on the Hitler front, I'm just completing, in the course of the next 6 weeks, a book on the Battle of the Somme, which is one of the battles in which Hitler was injured. Mm-hmm. And I reflect in that book on the fact that, you know, if it had not been a serious injury but a fatal injury, perhaps history would have been very different.
There's a fellow who did an article in commentary. It was Milton Himmelfarb years ago. The title of the article gave its whole thesis, No Hitler, No Holocaust.
I believe that's true. And had Churchill been killed in South Africa, or indeed had he been killed when he was run over in 1931 in New York by a car?
Mm.
He was squashed flat, he could easily have been killed, and perhaps things would have been very different. Perhaps a government in Britain would have said, rather like the United States was saying at the same time, that, you know, European affairs are not our business. Perhaps a British government would have said the same. We had our empire, we had our navy. Hitler conquered Poland and wanted to sort of bury the hatchet with Britain, conquered France and was quite happy to leave Britain alone. So perhaps if there hadn't been someone like Churchill who saw what was at stake and had the power to convince the British public that they could fight on, perhaps things would have been different.
A British author of some imaginativeness, what is his name? Richard Harris, I think, has a book written some years ago titled Vaterland, which is placed in Germany in the 1970s, thereabouts, and it's the world in which the Germans won.
Yes, I have a great admiration for Richard Harris because he tells this tale brilliantly, and you see there that somehow, you know, Nazism moderates because it's all powerful, and the world is happy to be within the German orbit, within the orbit of this great, powerful economic and Nazi country, but somehow totalitarianism becomes almost soft-gloved.
Might it have happened that way?
I don't think so. I don't think there was anything soft-gloved at all.
I don't think so, either.
It was bound to implode. It was so evil that it wouldn't... Mm. I mean, Hitler was already turning upon his own people, already had supreme contempt for them, and was murdering his closest colleagues, the people on whom he most depended, the senior army officers. It had become a Götterdämmerung.
You celebrate your birthday tomorrow, you told us.
Privately. I do indeed, yes.
And you're approaching 70, I would guess.
I'll be 69 tomorrow.
69 tomorrow.
70th year.
And you've done some 75 books. You're a very, very active contributor and a first-rate stuff. What do you have in store for us?
Well, the book I'm writing in the moment is on the Somme, on the Battle of the Somme. Mm-hmm. It's a study of heroism and horror of war. But the next book that will be published is on a Jewish theme, on Kristallnacht and its aftermath.
Really?
What did the Jews go through in Germany and Austria, and what happened to those who were witnesses of Kristallnacht? What was their fate? And that, I hope, will come out next spring.
You are always turning up in all of your work things that obviously first surprise you and then astonish us when we read them. What discoveries have you made about Kristallnacht?
Well, the first thing I discovered, and it was just a question of hard work, really. It's normally said that some 200 synagogues would destroyed. Mm-hmm. The upper limit is 242 in each of the books and on the internet. But the number is at least 1,000. And In my book, I try to explain why this was such a massive destruction. So well, of course, prepared beforehand, not spontaneous at all, as the Nazis later claimed.
I wish we could go on with that very discussion. But I look forward to, I would hope, seeing you here again when that book is published.
Thank you very much.
Martin Gilbert has been our guest tonight. He is the author of the new book, Churchill and America, which is just published by Free Press and is fascinating on every page.